A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home. Those five.
Robbie Brady against Hugo Lloris. Ireland leading Lyon. What a start. What a perfect start.
Crosses back to the edge of the penalty.
Into the penalty.
Get out!
The only thing that they have got is the big boy up front, Sigurdsson, who really, Sigthorsson.
You're talking about finals.
Final.
You know what I'm talking about.
I'm Declan Rice.
I'm Jack Grealish.
Oh my word.
They're all pampered. They're all just headphones.
Put some respect on my name.
Welcome, everybody, to your first of many Second Captains Euro 2020 podcasts. And it was a tricky start for our hero from that audio bed, Jack Grealish, I'm sure. I'm sure he was thrilled to see his teammates roar to victory against Croatia yesterday, but there must have been a little part of him. Sure, Jack Grealish wasn't actually watching the television footage, but the rest of us were watching the camera pick him out, warming up on the touchline, then going to Raheem Sterling. Looks like Sterling's going to get hooked. I mean, he was dangerous at times in the first half, but had started going out of the game a little bit. Finally, England's new hero will get his moment. And then, bang, Calvin Phillips, through ball to Sterling, knocks it in, runs towards the sideline. Grealish then finds himself part of the celebrations with the on-field players. Looking to me slightly, I don't know, maybe I was reading too much into it, but he looked to me like a man who knows that when Gareth Southgate settles on a winning team in a major tournament, he does not make too many changes to that winning team. So a tough one for Grealo to take, Ken, but what a start for his England.
Well, look, for Queen and Country, you know, it's a privilege just to be there. when the Queen is on the march, it's great just to be able to be part of the goal celebration. You never know. I mean, the goal celebrations, you could end up in a few. He could be the David May of this triumph.
Or the Reina, the Pepe Reina.
Pepe Reina, you know, and I mean, and that would be great, you know, that would be great, wouldn't it? So, I thought it was a very disappointing game overall, England against Croatia. I thought I would blame Croatia for that more than England. I think England played okay. I didn't think they were very good, but Croatia were awful. Really were, and you know, just had nothing really going for them. It wasn't the best of the. I mean, there's been a few games. There's been a few exciting ones. Probably the best one was the last one, the Netherlands Ukraine. Italy. Yeah. Owen, you were just so right about Italy.
So, right.
I was like, Italy are just straight into the groove. Like, this is just amazing. Like, look at, you know, they really absolutely. Rip Turkey to pieces.
See, I have a rule, Ken. When tipping up a dark horse for a major tournament, you go with one that's won loads of World Cups and that's on a 27-game unbeaten run. That's the kind of dark... Don't go for your Turkeys. Don't go for your Ukraines. Yeah. Go for a team that might actually win the tournament.
Yeah.
Like Italy,
yeah. No, you're right, Owen. It's a solid call. Italy look like they'll take some shifting. Wales against... I was watching Wales against Switzerland and I thought, well, you know, McDevitt was right last night, but now I'm right. This game is so bad. why is this tournament taking place? And then Switzerland scored, and I thought, wow, I'm right again. Wales are quite poor. You know, Wales could be going home in the first round, you know, and that emailer, you know, we'll have to eat humble pie.
Oh, yeah, we had an email in from Wales.
Because I was thinking bitterly about the email. Who wrote like a perfectly nice email saying, you know, I'm a World Service member who is from Wales. And, you know, you could have mentioned them. And I was thinking bitterly of that guy. And I was thinking, well, this is why we didn't talk about Wales. And then, obviously, Kiefer Moore equalised. And, yeah, we thought good header. And then Denmark-Finland happened, and that was the whole tone of the thing rather changed.
We'll get to that in a second. The games today are Scotland-Czech Republic at 2 o'clock, which should be fun. Poland-Slovakia, one of the ones that was ripped away from Dublin, that's on in St. Petersburg instead. Spain against Sweden could be interesting tonight as well. And we will, of course, have Euro 2020 podcast daily right through the tournament. You can join up now if you're not already a member to hear all of them on secondcaptains.com for a fiver a month. Plus VAT. Let's get stuck into them now.
It's time for me to do their soccer.
Oh. Talk us through that, Steve. I think we know what's happened, but talk us through it.
Oh, just saying. See Fawson.
An email here, and we do want to get as many emails from you as possible through the tournament. Get your thoughts. Declan Kelly says, "Dear second captains, I appreciated Ken's point last week that pre-match booing was an example of the English refusal to hear criticism. A far more trivial example, but quite telling, of that refusal was on display during the BBC's coverage of England-Croatia. When Harry Kane missed a decent chance after Sterling's opener, the commentator Guy Mowbray kept insisting the Croatian defender had made an heroic block, even when replays showed that, while he made it awkward for Kane, he didn't actually get a block on the shot. Then in the studio at full time, when Lineker went through the chances England created, the only one they showed was Mount's free kick. It was as if Kane's miss was redacted from the record. A few minutes later, when Lineker, through gritted teeth, asked if there was anything to be disappointed by in the performance, Shearer piped up and said, Kane looked a little slow and should have done better with that now non-existent chance he missed. The glare Frank Lampard was giving Shearer while he said this was incredible. When Shearer was done spouting his treason, Lampard immediately responded by saying that we don't need to doubt Harry Kane. He's our man. Having grown up on Dumpy, Giles and Brady, this refusal to criticise is staggering to me. Any explanations you can offer would help me through the next few weeks of BBC ITV broadcasts will be most welcome. Thank you, Declan.
Well, I mean, yeah, like, I mean, I think Shearer did criticise Kane there. Like,
that's,
you know,
what, according to the email, I didn't see the full time. I saw some of the pre-match on BBC. All right,
by saying, you know, that he was slow, and that's like, that's crushing, that's withering criticism, you know, in that context of the England captain by the former England captain.
He did look slow and sluggish and unfit even before he crashed into a post, I have to say.
Yeah, now, okay, it wasn't as good as what you would hear on RTE, where you had the man who was running Arsenal's academy at the time they decided not to renew Harry Kane, aged 8, talk about how Harry Kane wasn't world class and how he was a problem for England because he doesn't do anything. He said of the man who has more, I think, topped the Premier League in goals and assists, he doesn't do anything. He doesn't give you anything if he's not scoring. And actually, when Liam Brady was saying all this, I kind of, even though it sounds ridiculous to say this about the guy who is, you know, well, what are you talking about, Liam? He said stuff like, oh, he needs others to make his chances for him. You're kind of thinking, well, this does seem quite harshly critical of a guy who is both the top scorer and top assister in the league this season. You got to respect the numbers. And yet I kind of agreed a little bit with Brady. Like, you know, I'm never totally, you know, I mean, Harry Kane is on absolute top form, yeah, but I don't think he really has been for a while, has he? Like, he's, even the season just gone, a lot of his, you know, four of his assists were against Southampton, weren't they? And they, didn't they, when Tottenham sort of,
okay, four of his very, very many assists were against Southampton, but there are still four assists.
What I mean is there was a bit of a clustering towards the first half of the season with Kane in terms of his goals and his assists. And I don't really think he's been that good. But, you know, just in terms of the thing about, you know, criticism, like, I mean, Lampard was there. Like, Lampard was talking about his time as Chelsea manager, which I was actually scratching my head going, why has he even agreed to talk about this? Like, he shouldn't really be talking about this. But then I realized it's because he actually wants to claim credit. He wants to claim his share of credit in it for, like, bringing through Mace. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't think this comes across as ridiculous. You know, I'm kind of going, oh God, Frankie, no, I can't believe they're making you do this. But actually he was sort of like, I'm just proud to have been able to play my part in
Chelsea. I thought he laughed slightly awkwardly when Gary Lineker said, so let's talk about Mason Mount. Frankie, he's a player who had criticism at times last season. People thought he was a bit of a teacher's pet of yours. And I thought Lampard was a little bit like...
But like he talks about Mason Mount with such love. Like it's amazing. Like it's he's more than a teacher's pet. It's almost infatuation, Lampard to Mount. Like he's just blown away by this young man. Everything about him, not just the skills, but also his humanity. So, which is great. And in fairness, Lampard did show faith in Mount and was one of his great advocates, and that no one can ever take that away from Frank Lampard. But in the more general thing of like why are they not criticizing, it reminds me of I came across this clip which had been tweeted by Ian at Ian Drew Dice Clay. Thanks for tweeting a clip of Alan Green. She says, Alan Green's commentary in the Scotland game in 1996 is something else. Now, the Scotland game he's referring to is obviously the Euro 96 England-Scotland game. Alan Green was at the time BBC Five Live football commentator. This is halftime. They're obviously just about to rejoin the second half from Wembley. Take it away, Alan.
Wasn't that a pathetic first half? Absolutely shocking. I'm afraid it is just a parochial little affair, unless it dramatically improves over the next 45 minutes. Now, England have made a change at halftime. Jamie Redknapp has come on, and he's replacing Stuart Pearce. Presumably, Gareth Southgate will drop back into one of the three central defensive roles, and Redknapp will add a good deal more construction to what was a wretched England midfield. Gascoigne, I am amazed that he is still out there, because he has contributed nothing, Steve Coppell.
So,
wow. Tell us just what you really feel, Alan. Yeah,
yeah, just so you know, it's not always, hasn't always been policy to not criticize. I mean, how much criticism did he spout in that 30? Like, so angry and so wrong about so much. You know, Gazza, like, what's he still doing out there? Gazza, within a few minutes, goes out there and produces the greatest moment of England football in the past. It's now 55 years since they won the World Cup. Like, it's literally the greatest single moment in a match that they've had in that entire time, because not only is it an amazing goal, but it's actually the goal celebration is actually even better than the goal. And I say this about a goal, which is brilliant, but the goal celebration, everything. I mean, because he has actually laid it out. Like, if you see, it's only more recently that I noticed him actually point out the bottle that he wants them to use as he runs over to adopt the position of the dentist chair. You can see him do this. He's like, yes. And then he's pointing to the bottle as he runs and assumes the dentist chair position. And the dentist chair itself is him responding to all the Alan Greens out there. Because I think this is the big difference between 1996 and now, which is that now, not only the players, but also the audience, the uncountable millions in the audience, can answer back to the commentator. In the past, it was just Alan Green, the big man, sitting there with the microphone going, I have the conch, and you all have to listen to me speak my brains, because I have the conch, and I'm not going to let go of my tight grip on this conch. And I'll say whatever I like. This is shocking. It's disgusting. It's despicable. It's a disgrace. These England players are a disgrace. Gascoigne, why is he still out there? He has contributed nothing. And then moments later, Gascoigne does the most amazing thing that anyone has ever seen. It's like the greatest moment of England football. And everyone completely forgets that Alan Green ever said
there's
that.
There's no comeback on him. There's nothing. He doesn't have to hear anything about it.
No one remembers.
Maybe if he's having a pint down the local, Ken, he might get a bit of stick.
Someone might say, I distinctly remember hearing you say at halftime something about, oh, Gazza, I'm amazed he's still out there. What's he? He's done nothing. And Alan Green would say, well, I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't think I said that. Whereas now, literally, that would be clipped, and every time Alan Green ever said anything again on social media, which he would probably have to do because he'd be forced to do so by his broadcast employers to at least promote the work that he's doing, that clip would appear underneath. oh, aren't you the genius who said Gascoigne? You know, but the point is, if you're dishing out as much criticism as Alan Green does in that clip, prepare to receive it back 10,000-fold from all the people you're annoying in the audience.
He went down in my estimation when he said that.
From all the people who are listening, who is this dickhead? Like, who is this guy? Like, and how, where does he get off speaking about people in this way? Has this guy never made a mistake? Has this guy never got anything wrong? And here he is going, there's a, it's a disgrace, it's shocking, blah, blah, blah. You see what I mean, right?
We have not resorted to that.
So I think that's one very important reason why, as soon as I heard that clip, I was like, wow, like it's kind of
they don't make it like that anymore.
Yeah. No, they don't. You just don't hear people speak that way anymore because they know that like it's going to come back. And I suppose, you know, looking back over the years with the Irish, the broadcast punditry in Ireland, which everyone was always saying, oh, it's much better, you know, when it was, especially when it was about the premiership and stuff like that, when RTE would have the premiership. It's like, it is a bit easier to speak in this way when you know that, like, you know, their agent is not ringing you up half
an
hour after the
show. Yeah,
that
was always
a game. You know what I mean? So there is an element there of those BBC analysts being a bit closer to their subject matter. And I don't just mean in the unhealthy way of, oh, they're too close to the people they're talking about. You know, they don't want to say anything bad about them, or, you know, they've, you know, there's some kind of connections which are being hidden from the audience between them. I just mean in the sense of, I know they and all their family will be watching this. So I just want to be sure that I'm actually fair and don't just, in an offhand way, in front of an audience of millions of people, say something cruel, dismissive, insulting. You know, that sort of thing, like, which I think is a legitimate thing to have in your head. It's always it's a balance that a broadcaster is going to have to, you know, a live broadcaster is going to have to strike that balance between, I have to say something which is at least a little bit interesting for the audience, but I also have to be conscious of not wanting to just trample on people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So,
yeah, it is kind of mad to hear the clip of Alan Green there. Just how mad we all go about the stuff that shouldn't really matter.
Because if you can do that, then it means that everything is, all is right in the world. Yeah. All is right in the world because we can all sit here getting absolutely carried away about something that doesn't actually matter.
Yeah, as opposed to what does matter over the weekend, the biggest story, the biggest thing that happened, obviously the cardiac arrest suffered by Christian Eriksen on the field in Copenhagen. He was gone, said the Denmark team doctor, Morten Boson, on Sunday. We started the resuscitation. We managed to do it. How close were we to losing him? I don't know, but we got him back after one defibrillation. So that's quite fast. Denmark's coach, Kasper Hjulmand, said they are now doing a series of tests at the hospital. This was yesterday, that can maybe give some of the answers him and I are looking for. But he's awake. He's answering questions. Clearly, his heart is beating again. So, I mean, that's the main thing. And everyone wishes Christian Eriksen well. It was just a truly shocking moment to witness on TV. Nobody can imagine what the players went through at the time, and then having to come back out and now having to get ready for another game in a few days. It seems kind of nuts. Daniel Murphy sends an email from Copenhagen, a brief report after a shocking weekend. Hi lads, I'm an Irish guy currently living in Copenhagen with my Danish girlfriend. Thought I'd give you a quick email about my experience during the Eriksen incident. We live in Østerbro, which is, pardon the pronunciation there, which is in the east borough of the city where Parken Stadium is located. There was an amazing party atmosphere leading up to the game. My girlfriend and I went for coronavirus tests on Saturday morning to get fresh corona passes for the day. These give recipients unrestricted access to bars and restaurants around the country for 72 hours upon a negative result. As we left the test centre, which also happens to be in the same park beside the stadium, there were already loads of people gathered in jerseys at 10 o'clock in the morning. Songs were being sung, feet were being moved, and beer was being drunk. By the time the game started, my girlfriend and I were fortunate enough to have secured our negative coronavirus tests and a couple of seats in a local bar. The atmosphere was great. Everyone was feeling confident. Then, in an instant, the mood completely changed. I really can't remember any details from the game or Eriksen falling over, for that matter. The image I can recall is seeing a defibrillator being used on Eriksen. At that moment, I turned to my girlfriend, who was in complete shock. I'll never forget her face, and asked, is he dead? She remained silent. Shortly after, she started shaking profusely. As they carried Eriksen off the pitch, my girlfriend and I left the pub. We didn't know where to go. She just needed to get out of there. For whatever reason, we naturally started walking back toward our flat. As we did, we saw two large police vans and two ambulances speed past us toward the stadium. Apart from the sound of their sirens, the city was completely silent. In fact, every person that we passed on our way home appeared to be in stunned silence. I'm sure that we looked the exact same to them as well. Oh, this is actually mad even just reading this out. Like, it's still so close to the thing happening. But anyway, as of Sunday evening, despite knowing that Eriksen is currently in a stable condition, it feels like the tournament is already over here in Denmark. Nobody expects anything of the team now, and rightly so. If my girlfriend, who has never met Eriksen before, had such a strong reaction to the incident, then imagine what his teammates must be going through at the moment. At the same time, though, the Danish public are currently showing great sense of gratitude towards their team. The way the players came together on the pitch to protect and prioritise the well-being of someone among them speaks to the Danish communal spirit. That much I can attest to myself. All the best. From Daniel Murphy. Really good email there, Daniel, to editor at secondcaptains.com. And I think now it is time to bring in Richie and Jonathan.
Fair to say anybody could have managed those guys?
No, of course not.
It was about 12.
Everyone in the city knew about it, but no one had seen him.
Look how happy I was. What the fuck happened? No, really. What happened? What happened?
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
It's our first time in the tournament checking in with Richie and Jonathan Wilson. Jonathan, how are things?
Yeah, good, thanks. How are you?
Good, good, good. How are you, Richie?
Lads, how are you getting on? You well?
Yeah, how are you getting on? There was a nice crazy game for you last night on RTE, the Netherlands-Ukraine. Always nice to have a slightly bonkers game on the opening weekend to cover.
It was great. I was more pleased to be covering that one than other ones, to be perfectly honest, on reflection. But it was great. Like, we were sitting before, actually, in the production meeting beforehand, going, God, wouldn't it be great if this is the game that really kicked things off? There were a load of goals, a lot of excitement and plenty of action, and there was. It was really good.
Nothing like a Ukrainian goalkeeper being man of the match in the first half and then practically throwing a couple in the second half to get things going. Jonathan, what are your general impressions of the opening weekend? I mean, I know I'm kind of beating around the bush here because one story is hovering over everything. Yeah, but football-wise?
Well, I've actually been pretty encouraged. I sort of... I don't know. You know, the dynamic of this tournament is so different. You know, I mean, I heard Ken talk about this last week, but this is the first tournament I haven't been at since, first major tournament I haven't been at since 2002. And so it's a very different thing just watching it on telly. And I, you know, had to cover the game on the Denmark-Finland game on Saturday. And yeah, you feel a bit of a fraud because as a journalist, you should be there and you should be finding out what's going on. And you're doing it very secondhand. I mean, you're still ringing people up and you're still monitoring social media and you're looking at Danish newspapers and Danish websites to try and find out what's going on. But it just sort of doesn't really feel like you're doing the job properly. But from a football point of view, I think I've been gently encouraged. I don't know. And again, this might be when you're in the tournament, there are different pressures and different stresses. But I didn't really enjoy Euro 2016. I sort of found it a bit of a slog. I thought there was a lot of the football, particularly in the group stage, was pretty poor. And I don't really think we've had a poor game yet. And I think there's evidence that certain sides are playing pretty well and are prepared to be a little bit more proactive than teams maybe often are in international tournaments, which actually continues the pattern we saw at the World Cup. So hopefully that is a thing in international football. And that Netherlands-Ukraine game, I was watching it with a beer. I wasn't working on it, but I really enjoyed that.
Richie, you said you were glad you weren't covering the Denmark game. Have you been, like, I don't know what the sort of atmosphere even around Orti has been like. Obviously, there was Liam Brady and Damien Duff on it, and you could visibly see how upset they were covering it, as everybody was even watching the thing. Duff said he couldn't, you know, as it was going on, he was just pacing around the studio and couldn't look at the scenes or anything like that. Have you been talking to them since?
I have, yeah. I spoke to Duffer during the programme, actually. But I was sitting in to watch it. I'm sure the lads were the same in the studio. It's a Saturday afternoon. Like, will we be entertained? Will we see something memorable? You know, will the team you want to win? All the usual stuff you bring to a football tournament or watching a game. And then when this happened, I was watching on my own in the sitting room at home, and it did kind of, as you're trying to grapple with, well, what actually are we watching here? What scenes are unfolding in before us? And then very quickly, my mind turned to, oh my God, like, they're, imagine working on this. Imagine being the match commentator who has to talk over these pictures, or the producer who has to decide, when do we cut from these pictures? Should we stay with them? And then have to be the pundits in the studio to try and you know, describe what they've seen, contextualize us, give their feelings on it, and to be the presenter to have to to hold it all together. I was, and then you look, in no particular order, you just feel for so many people, the people who have to work on it, but more than anyone, the Christian Eriksen himself, but the teammates, the ring around him, the medics that were there, the referee, and then the pictures of Eriksen's partner. There was so much going on. Like, your emotions are being assaulted from all sorts of different angles in the most unexpected way, because again, you're sitting there watching a football game. But I was sitting there in my sitting room, as distressing as it was, there was a part of me going, I'm glad I'm on this couch rather than in that studio.
Do you think they should have finished the game?
Like, so I'll couch the answer a little bit initially, saying I assume there were legal issues to consider for UEFA. There was commercial and broadcasting contracts. I assume the financial cost or the disruption of not restarting the game would have had all sorts of ramifications. But I just think it was wrong to have to expect those players, given what they had just gone through. And like, I've heard people, you know, even in the coverage of the game on Saturday, people were using phrases like, you know, we fear in the worst here, or, you know, we hope the outcome's going to be good, and we're all praying and wishing for him to pull through. But like, at one point, like, I'm sure I wasn't the only one who thought this, but when I saw the footage of Eriksen lying there with his eyes open, thinking, is that a dead body we're looking at? And if you can imagine being in the shoes of the teammates, who have a very close personal relationship with Eriksen, who are in the vicinity of what is happening, a couple of them attended to him immediately, and then they had the presence of mind to stand in a circle around him to prevent the eyes of the world watching what was happening. But they would have been seeing a lot more than we saw, and they would have heard a lot more than we saw. We were able to hear from where we were. And I'm sure at some point there were moments in those players' minds where they thought, oh my God, has he died? Now, you can't think those thoughts without feeling the emotions that are attached to it. And if you've just felt the emotions of losing your friend in those circumstances, in that setting, like, the fact that he kind of pulled through within a matter of minutes, or he was up, sitting upright in the stretcher as he was leaving the pitch, or talking to them, or whatever. At whatever point in their experience, they realised, okay, it looks like this is going to have a positive outcome here. It doesn't gloss over or erase the impact or the trauma of those moments that they spent thinking, oh my God, has he just died? So then to expect them to play. Now, the wording of the UEFA statement that we first got, which was as a result of a request from both sets of players, and immediately,
yeah, that was the first line in the statement, following the request made by players of both teams.
Yeah, and I wondered, oh God, I'd say that's very liberal, general use of that phrase there, because what we've learned since is they had two options. Do you restart it as they did, or play at 12 o'clock the following day? I assume the 12 o'clock was because it doesn't disrupt the following day's TV scheduling. And I'm just wondering, I said this in RT last night, was there an option C? Mm. Was it spelled out to them, listen lads, this is the consequences of not playing tonight or tomorrow? Was it like the team that refused to play, is it a 3-0 defeat? Are you expulsion from the competition, a ban from subsequent tournaments? Like, what actual choice was given to the players? Because if it was lads play tonight or tomorrow, that's not a choice, that's an ultimatum. That you've got to play this regardless. We've got commercial and broadcasting responsibilities which far exceed your welfare. Like, that would be the message that's being delivered here. So I think, I was so uncomfortable watching that second half. Because again, like, you do what you always do. You sit there and you start to assess their performance. And it just felt really wrong trying to assess the performance of players having gone through what they'd gone through.
You could see it, couldn't you? I mean, the sub who came on, Jensen, looked upset coming on. Simon Kjær, the captain, went off, and it was confirmed by the manager afterwards that he just wasn't able to. He tried to go and play and he just couldn't handle it. So he had to come off the pitch, understandably. So, I mean, we could all see this going on. And yet, it was just such a weird experience watching the rest of the game. Jonathan, what do you make of the decision of UEFA? And it's UEFA's, I mean, they can say the players decided, but UEFA decided that the match was to go ahead yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, well, I was in that in that press conference. I mean, yeah, it's virtual, so you know, it's an extra level of remove, and also dealing through simultaneous translation. So there were two things that struck me about it. One was, I thought Yuleman was incredibly impressive in his tone and the way he sort of presented it. And from his tone, I don't think he felt pressured to play the game. And he was very keen to stress that he'd said to the players, and the word he kept using, or the word that kept being used in the translation was dare. You have to dare to let us know how you feel. So I think he was making very clear in that press conference, he had said to the players, what do you want to do? If you don't want to play, we don't play. But they've been, and but you don't know what tone the options given to them by UEFA were presented with. But then the other phrase that struck me, and again, yeah, does this sound slightly different in English to how it would sound in the original Danish? He was saying the players eventually came to the conclusion that what they didn't want to do was go away that night, probably not sleep, and then have to come back on the bus and do it all again the next day. And so the phrase he used was, it was best to get it over with. Now, again, in Danish, that might be a much more neutral phrasing than it sounds in English. But that made me uncomfortable. Get it over with. I mean, that's not the way it should be. And Simon Kerr, as you say, he obviously did find it impossible. And he'd been right at the centre. He'd been the person who put Ericsson on his side. He'd been the person comforting Ericsson's wife. So, he was right at the forefront of it. I don't know. I mean, Richie will know this far better than me, but I can sort of understand a sense that the players have sort of, well, we do just want to get on with this. But whether that was the right decision to make, I don't know.
It's difficult because even we're using phrases like what's the right and wrong call, like in one way, it's very reasonable to turn around and say, well, you know what, if the players wanted to play for whatever reason, let's say they said, you know what, this is the lesser of the two evils, get it out of the way now rather than tomorrow. Or let's say they're internally saying, listen, lads, we actually don't care about the result here. We just need to tick a box and get this game played to full-time whistle. Then that's fine. But you turn around as well and go, well, are those players in the right state of mind to be given the decision-making powers in this scenario compared to someone who has concussion? That's an obvious example that everyone can understand. You don't look at someone who's just gone experienced concussion and say, it's up to you what you do now. There's a general sense that this fella's he's not well enough or clear thinking enough to make a call here on what's in their best interests. So, and if players turned around and said like they absolutely didn't want to play, again, you understand this is a tournament situation, so UEFA will have to try and work out the consequences of that. And I just wonder, like, let's say, was it ever suggested that there was a realistic option on the table to say, okay, there is an option here. If both teams are in agreement that we end the game and we just stick to the scoreline as it was nil all. We take a point each and we move on to match day two.
It puts Finland in an awkward position, though, doesn't it?
It does. Like, it's a horrible situation. There's no easy route. There's no obvious right answer. There's no outcome that you think is satisfactory for everyone because of the circumstances. And everyone involved, like the global viewing audience as well, is to some degree like distressed or upset or traumatized. So it's very difficult set of circumstances to make a clear call on something that is going to tick all the boxes. The commercial ones, the broadcasting ones, the legal ones, the player welfare ones, the compassionate ones, because they're kind of all kind of conflicting really in this scenario. But it was really uncomfortable watching them. I can't imagine what it was like playing for them, but like Jonathan said, that the right tone was struck in the press conference, and we know from the statements from the team doctor yesterday that psychologists were brought in to support the players on the evening and the following day. So, like, all the right calls are seemingly made to support the players here, because they're going to need a huge amount of support, because they're all going to be impacted in really, really different ways. But it's obviously a set of circumstances that nobody nobody at all was expecting or would want to be encountering or talking about at this point. Like, in one way, I was sitting there going, God, this is like one of the most distressing things you could ever possibly see. And then when you see the statements from the club doctor and you hear about how bad things were initially, he used the phrase like he was gone. It was a cardiac resuscitation. We got him back. And you think, wow, we're reflecting on the most extraordinary, uplifting, inspiring thing you could possibly see in a game of football. Like, fuck moments of skill or hat-tricks or big goals in big games. Like, we saw a group of people, from Simon Kerr, who was there on the moment, to Schmeichel organising the players, the medics quick thinking, the referees clear thinking, a collective effort from a number of people, saved this fella's life. Like, to use the doctor's phrase, like, he was gone and now he's alive and he's joking about having his boots and ready to play again. Like, that's as extraordinary and as inspiring as things can ever get on the field. And it was amazing, but just, like, trying to compose your thoughts and your words about what it was like is even tricky 2 days later, to go back to what I said a moment ago, how the hell pundits did it on the day in any kind of coherent way is incredible.
Oh yeah, no, I thought they did it as good a job as you can do in the circumstances. But
so just on the point of the doctor, one of the extraordinary things about that press conference was he was sitting next to Kasper Hjulmand, Morten Børsen, and it took me a little while to work out who he was, because I'd missed the intro, and they kept on calling him Morten, and I worked out from what he was saying he was the doctor, and then suddenly he sort of gives this very calm sentence by sentence description of, yeah, we got summoned on, we ran onto the pitch. When we got there, he was on his side, his heart was still beating, and suddenly it wasn't. And you sort of, yeah, exactly, as Richie just said, you sort of think, Jesus, like, you know. And the weird thing was, he was doing it in the style of a post-match press conference. It was the most banal phrase, it's the most extraordinary thing.
Yeah.
And then he obviously, I think he subsequently gave a much longer, I don't know if it was a press conference or an interview or a statement, where he talked about the psychological help the players are getting and everything. But, you know, he used the phrase in that press conference about, we got him back. And again, because it was in Danish, I didn't quite know if that meant what I thought it meant. So I didn't sort of stress that when I was writing about it. I left that phrase in, but I didn't sort of say, yeah, he had actually died, and they resuscitated him. But yeah, clearly that was what had happened.
Richie, do you agree with the general feeling that we as viewers, that everybody around the world saw too much of that, too much of what went on, and more than we should have done?
I'd love if I saw less, to be honest, reflecting back on it.
At the same time, though, Richie, you were saying that what we did see was kind of, you know, I mean, if the cameras had decided to discreetly draw away from everything that was happening, we really wouldn't have any idea of the scene that unfolded, including the sort of heroic aspects of it that you've described.
Yeah, I suppose, I sitting there on the couch on my own, initially, I missed the moment, because I'm sure you're the same. When you're covering a tournament, you've a laptop open and you're looking at your screens, and I was kind of preparing for other games as well. And so I missed the actual moment where Eriksen fell to the ground. So and within 3 seconds, before I realised there was anything actually serious going on, I just rewinded it to see what happened. And so I saw that, and then it was just that there was a moment where I think you could see him through the players, and his eyes were open and he was motionless. And I was got, oh my God. I don't know if any of you have ever seen a dead body or arrived at a scene where someone has just died. I have, and you're immediately brought back to that, and you're going, Christ, this is difficult. And then you're watching the scenes of his partner being embraced by Schmeichel and consoled. Like, it was heartbreaking. Also, you could say, well, this is extraordinary. Look at Schmeichel, and look at the presence of mind he has to go to the person who's in most need of support here, and he's being the one providing the support. Can you imagine what he's gone through himself? So again, you're right, these scenes are both really inspiring and heroic and extraordinary for all positive reasons. But I don't know, like, there's been loads of commentary in the last couple of days about decisions made in all the various different TV channels that they should have known to call it sooner. And yes, they were upsetting, but, like, we all had the option of turning off the TV as well. like, we need to take our own responsibility there as well. Like, I stayed watching it in part because I thought, well, this is like really, really disturbing stuff, and you want to stay with it to see how it's going to end or how it's going to go. You're hoping he's going to pull through, and yeah, if he is going to pull through, you want to know straight away, and you'll only know that by sticking with the pictures.
I think that, though, yeah, I see. I think I was exact same with you, Richie. You're watching it hoping to see, like, to be, there'd been two, like, you're hoping to see signs of life. You can see, I think that decision should be taken out of the viewer's hands, to be honest. Human nature is to watch. I think there was an opportunity. Like, it starts with there's the individual TV stations. They have a decision to make when they're seeing these shots about, at any stage, do we just pull back to studio? Do we make a different call here? I mean, the first port of call is the director responsible, for the people responsible for the feed themselves, the UEFA feed. And I saw the guy, Jean-Jacques Anseam, was talking to L'Équipe. He was the director in charge. He says that there's no handbook for these incidents. There was a slow motion of the scene where we can see him fall really clearly, but I immediately forced my teams not to focus on him, not to film him anymore. During the live coverage that followed, I did at one moment show Danes in tears because it was still necessary to show the distress. We also saw the emotions of the Finns and the crowd, but I don't think we did anything mawkish or creepy. Now, the only thing is, Jonathan, what he doesn't mention there is that we saw Ericsson's wife, obviously, in distress. And I think the first few seconds are quite understandable. Like, everyone's just trying to get used to what has happened here. Nobody really has a clue. And I think the point that what Richie describes, when you see the look on Ericsson's face initially, it's very hard to for them to have cut away from that because it was all happening so fast. But from that point, like, from the point that the Danes start forming a guard around him, I think you can really forget about showing anything on the pitch at that stage. And I know he's saying that they didn't zoom in for close-ups, but they were still showing that scene, and you could still see, you could see bits of what was going on behind, and you could see Ericsson's legs, and you're hoping to see movement. So and this is a little bit long-winded, but I do feel there was an opportunity. I think there was too much shown. I don't think there was a need to show it all. And after the initial shock of the first few seconds, once the seriousness of what was going on was obvious, there was opportunities to move away from it.
Yes. I mean, I think, though, there's two slightly separate strands there. Yeah. So one is, there's the journalism aspect of it, which is, I guess, you record what's happened as best you can. Obviously, there are limits, and you don't want to be invasive. But that, I think, is very difficult for the individual cameraman to get right. It then becomes a directorial decision. But you've got the complication that, so for instance, in Denmark and I think in Norway, they were able to cut immediately. They had a drone over the stadium, so they had a long shot of the stadium, and they still had the commentator in situ in the stadium who could describe what he was seeing. Now, for instance, BBC didn't have that option because they didn't have the access to the drone footage. So they then have two options, which is you go back to the studio where you have pundits who have no idea what's going on because they can't see it, or you somehow put something on the screen while you still have Jonathan Pearce and Martin Keown talking about it. And, you know, I could completely echo Richie's point that, you know, I was covering the game, but although I had to write quickly, I was very lucky that what I was writing wasn't going out live. You know, I had time to assess it and to revise it and make sure I got the tone right. And then there was two more editors it went through before it ever was seen by anybody. You don't have that luxury if you're a commentator or a pundit. So probably it did go on too long, but I think there are, and particularly because of COVID, the BBC don't have their own cameras there. You're far more restricted in what feed there is, and that I think makes it much harder. So yeah, probably it did go on too long, but I think it's understandable. And how long too long? 2 minutes? 5 minutes?
What is it? It's not an amount of minutes, I suppose. From the point of view, look, I think the camera person is doing their job, as you're saying, in documenting what's going on. The people in charge of the footage of the hosts, the worldwide broadcast, then have to make the decision of what they show. And it's not like, oh, we showed this for 30 seconds or 1 minute. I just sort of felt it was quite obvious after, say, 30 seconds or whatever it was, after you saw Ericsson's face the first time, it was quite obvious just let's not show any cameras that are pointing towards anywhere near Ericsson at this point.
Yeah,
let's not show Ericsson's wife either, you know, I mean.
Yeah, but even that, I mean, okay, I think they lingered too long there. But I can completely understand the kind of, oh, look, here's something going on with Schmeichel and Kerr and this woman. And oh, God, that's who that woman is. Yeah, and at that point, they should cut away. So probably they should have just gone to the longer shot they had. But I don't know. I think it's a really difficult call.
Richie?
Yeah, I think I'd have sympathy for the people who had to make the decisions in those circumstances straight away, because again, like when you use the phrase that like there isn't a handbook to deal with this, and I know you could turn around and say, well, listen, they have a responsibility and they should have made the absolutely appropriate call sooner. But again, I don't know what the right amount of time is to leave a scene like that. I don't know what. I don't know. I've no real view on that, because it's a set of circumstances which was not in anyone's mind going into the game. And I suppose we didn't really know exactly what we were watching. We knew there's someone in a huge amount of distress. And like, again, when you're covering a match, is there an obligation to cover this aspect of it? And is that best done by, as Jonathan said, going back to pundits who are probably going to find it very hard to even string sentences together, who have no actual knowledge of what's happening, can't provide any information or update, and might just reflect on their feelings, but they might be equally ill-equipped, even more ill-equipped, to represent what's happening, because they might stray into using phrases and speculating things or making a call that is really, really inappropriate and really like adding to everyone's distress. So I would just, again, have sympathy for everyone. But yeah, in hindsight, you think, yeah, like, don't show his partner. Like that's just that's a basic thing. Just a don't show that. But the other stuff then, again, I don't know how people would make a call on that.
Well, listen, I mean, tough scene all around, and thankfully Christian Eriksen's doing better. There's no easy segue into the football, Jonathan, so I'll just say let's talk about the football and talk about England yesterday, and a pretty impressive England, it must be said. I mean, you've got all sorts of good stuff going on. Raheem Sterling finding form. Calvin Phillips emerging already as the diamond in the rough. I mean, what a performance he put in.
I thought Phillips was absolutely magnificent. I was delighted for him, because I'd sort of thought he should play. I thought it made sense to play him and Rice. But I could also sense that he was being lined up to be the scapegoat. You know, when England ground to a 0-0 draw, you know, it's going to be, oh, why have they played the two holding players? Why is Phillips there? But he was, you know, I thought he was England's best player. And actually, it occurs to me that, I mean, you know, he's become sort of a special project for Bielsa. The Bielsa clearly really rates him, really likes him. He's the heart of that Leeds team. And you realise this England team is actually weirdly Bielsa influenced, because you had another six who started on Sunday, whose sort of formative years spent either under Pochettino or under Guardiola, both of whom, you know, openly, readily, willingly acknowledge their debt to Bielsa. And I think that's actually a more general theme of the tournament, that of the seven games we've had so far, three of them featured sort of major Western European nations. So Italy and Belgium beating Turkey and Russia 3-0. Okay, England weren't quite as dominant against Croatia, but still I thought a pretty convincing display. So these sort of wealthy Western nations who over the last sort of 20, 25 years have pumped a huge amount of money into youth development, who have this sort of, I think academies tend to produce these players who are very comfortable pressing, playing this quite aggressive, quick game. And the thing that I think has made those three games so one-sided, maybe slightly too strong a term, but so tipped one way rather than the other, is that they have just looked quicker and stronger and better organised than the three sides from further east.
Croatia looked terrible though, didn't they? I mean,
they looked so old.
They looked like, yeah, they should have just retired after the last World Cup. And I've never seen a side miss.
Mass.
Well, you know, I mean, it would have been a good time to
well,
knock
there's
it on
a
the
moment.
Head
I think it was around about 18 minutes. So just at the end of England's really good spell, because I thought the first 20, 25 minutes England were really, really good, and it just sort of dipped a little after that. Mm. When Mason Mount ran away from Luka Modric. And you'd see Luka Modric looking at him thinking, hang on, didn't we just do this in that Champions League semi-final? Do I really have to chase Mason Mount again? Mm. And I think it's a similar thing, that the more aggressive That's physically.
The latest thing I've heard Mason Mount being praised for, faster than a 35-year-old little guy. Well done, Mason. But I just feel as though Croatia, like, you know, I've never seen, like, Mario Mandzukic was just so badly missed, you know, like anyone to kind of supply some sort of cutting edge here. And so what I feel about it was that England, it kind of worked out, the day ultimately worked out quite well for England, but I still feel like there's a lot of tension there, which is actually unresolved by that result and that by that performance. Like, you could see the tension in Sterling's interview after the game, where he was asked by the BBC reporter Kelly Summers a question which ended with the line, "You've justified your place in the team." And honestly, his reaction was just like, "Justified my place in the team?" And then he was like, it was like the question he obviously thought was so stupid that he was at a loss to think of really what to say, and Kelly Summers had to come in again. I'm reminded of myself talking to Roy Keane that time about asking him why faking injury was a bad idea, and had to sort of supply some extra words so that Sterling could say. But like, that is a really interesting situation still. Southgate picked Sterling, who has, if you look at it, 19 goal involvements, I think, in his last 17 England matches, right? Which is excellent. He's been a consistent presence in the team for many years now. He's the most experienced player in the team, and yet quite a lot of people don't want him in the team. It's a really bizarre. Like, just before he scored, what did he do? He miscontrolled the ball out of play, and the camera immediately started to show Grealish and the crowd cheering Grealish, and then Sterling scored just about in the nick of time. But like, it's sort of interesting that a player who's done so much and is of such high status seems to and something which he obviously, I think, senses as well, judging by his reaction in that interview, seems to be kind of just, should he be in, should he be out?
Yeah, but I mean, I think things like that often happen in international football, that playing for England, he's been fine, although that was his first goal in a major tournament. But his form over the last 2 or 3 months for City has been pretty poor. So we sort of in the wider public's heads, you know, he's not in great form. In an England sense, he is still in very good form. And also, there are two. I mean, Grealish, I think, is not a replacement. I think, you know, it's Grealish or Foden. But Rashford and Jadon Sancho are very good potential replacements for him. So I understand why there's pressure there. And I thought, actually, it was very typical of Sterling when he's not quite at his best. That there's loads of really good stuff there. His movement was obviously great. But he missed that great chance, what was about 10 minutes after he'd scored, when the corner dropped to him, he had loads of time and he smashed it over the bar, partly because Harry Kane, you know, threatened to get in his way. And even the finish, it wasn't the most convincing finish.
He did his best to miss it, didn't he? Like, it was just, he was absolutely blessed that one ended up going in.
So I kind of, my feeling with him always is he's a slightly frustrating player because he 95% of the stuff he does brilliantly, but he has that sort of slightly dithering tendency when he's not quite his best.
Well,
I think in key moments.
I think technically he's not quite as good technically as he is tactically, if you know what I mean. Like, so he makes good runs. Like, you know, like the run for the goal basically made the goal. Like, even though he waited forever.
But I think that goal is a classic sort of goal of a Bielsa Guardiola model, that he has the ball on the left, there's no option, so they recycle it round the back four. And by doing that, they just pull Croatia out slightly. That creates a space for Phillips to make the run. Walker's pass is perfect for him. His first touch takes him past the first defender. His momentum then takes him past the second defender. And that itself has opened up space for Sterling to run into. And it's exactly the what Guardiola would say the point of possession is. It's to reset and to just pull the opposition out of shape slightly. And that worked perfectly, and Sterling was the beginning and the end of that.
Yeah.
So that would back up what you're saying, absolutely.
Well, yeah, he's just technically a little bit erratic, so that he does things like he miscontrolled it out of play, or his shooting is sometimes not the cleanest, and these are the things that people really notice. Whereas the runs that he makes are a little bit more difficult to notice, so maybe you don't necessarily appreciate what he's bringing. Whereas Grealish is kind of like, Grealish is like Velcro touch, you know what I mean? Like, he's brilliant, like technically brilliant, which is I guess what sticks in people's head. But just given that you were talking tactics there, I do want to get an explanation. I haven't yet heard a good one as to why Gareth Southgate picked Kieran Trippier. What was he? I saw that Kieran Trippier was playing left back and I thought, this is insane. Like, what are you doing? Like, regardless of who the best player is, right? If you've got almost forget. If you've got three options for left back, one of them is the Man United PFA team. You think he was PFA team this season, right? Sure, left back. One of them is the Chelsea Champions League winning left back, right? And one of them is a right back. You've got to pick. You've surely got to pick one of the first two. Like technically, tactically, politically, whatever way you look at it, picking Trippier seemed like an insane decision. So, what do you think was the method in the madness there?
I think it was concern about Tyrone Mings, the mistakes he'd made in the two friendlies. The Trippier sort of naturally is somebody who would cover across behind him in a way that Chilwell and Shaw wouldn't. Maybe England lost a little bit of thrust going forward down the left as a result, but on the flip side of that, they gained Trippier's dead ball expertise. So it was one of those decisions that surprised me when I first saw it, but the more I thought about it, the more I sort of thought, yeah, that actually does make some kind of sense.
So you reckon he'll stick with that?
I've no idea. I think it's possible that he'll make three or four changes for the Scotland game. That might involve bringing Grealish in, because I assume Scotland will sit quite deep against England, so maybe you do want a sort of more naturally creative presence. But then my issue with Grealish is he doesn't play in one of these Bielsa, Guardiola, Pochettino pressing teams at club level. Is that something that comes naturally or easy to him? I don't know.
Richie, there's a lot there from Jonathan on the England performance. What do you take from it?
The Trippier stuff grabbed my eye as well, like everyone else before the game. And the explanation that it was possibly to provide extra cover for Mings, I've heard that several times. I just wondered, like, how is that communicated internally within the squad? I'm always really curious about the internal dynamics of a squad, particularly this England squad, given the numerous different ways in which you could argue they could line up their team. But whether there's much tension between the players or whether they're all this united group, maybe Jonathan will know more about that. But when you're explaining to a team, okay, we're going to go with Trippier in left full, assume everyone is straight away going to go, okay, well, that's interesting. Like, do they explain it? Like, is Mings being told privately, listen, we're just a bit concerned with you, so we're going to leave the left-backs off and put Trippier there? Would you not pick Shaw and Chilwell and give them extra instructions to maybe be a little bit more, like, alter their play slightly to factor in that Mings is there? Is that another solution? So just wondering how internally that's all played out, because when you used the phrase a moment ago, Jonathan, you did, about whether Phillips is like set up as almost like the scapegoat. I always get that feeling watching England now, and particularly at the weekend. It's like, everyone's waiting. Who'll we blame for this? What's the one decision we're going to go mad about if this doesn't go wrong? Or who's going to be the hero and that we're going to be champion? Everything's, the reactions are also set up to be so extreme, which I assume is just England in major tournaments, is it?
Yeah, but I don't think it's just England. I think it's the vast majority of national teams, that because a club team will play 60 games a year, a national team plays a dozen games a year, and of that dozen, half a dozen won't matter, and another three will be against teams that you play terribly and beat them 3-0. And so there's so few international games that matter. Everything is extraordinarily magnified. And you see that even with the friendlies. You know, if Manchester City's last two friendlies before the season start are disappointing, pretty flat 1-0 wins with much changed teams against, Rapid Vienna and Steaua Bucharest, nobody thinks twice about them. They just sort of think, well, they're friendlies. But the England friendlies, so suddenly we have to draw these massive conclusions from them because we've got so little evidence. And Trippier did play left-back in both those games. Oddly, that is the one clue that was given for us that everybody missed.
But it was the misdirection, though, of Southgate is conserving the energy of his key men, Luke Shaw and Chilwell.
And also Shaw and Chilwell obviously were absent because of playing in the European finals. Mm. So, you know, hysteria is part of international football. I think it's very easy if your experience of watching or covering international football is just seeing England, to think that it's unique to us. But, you know, England compared to, say, Nigeria is nothing. You know, the hysteria around the Nigeria squad is millions of times greater. And I think one of the things Southgate has done very, very well is to temper that as far as possible, to not be distracted by that, as I think Roy Hodgson was distracted before the 2014 World Cup when he switched to an ostensibly more attacking approach that failed horrendously. having been very solid and very dull in the friendlies. I think he understands that and plays that game pretty well.
Yep, that's pretty good chat, lads, for openers. I think we'll leave it there, seeing as there are three more games on today, some of which might already be on by the time people are listening. Richie, what are you on? When are you next on the telly?
I am, off my schedule here next to me, I am on tomorrow night, Tuesday night, for the France-Germany game with Didi.
Ah, not a bad one.
it's a decent one. Yeah, but there's a couple of double headers coming up. This is usually the time in every conversation in every tournament I own where you interrupt and tell me to shut up whinging.
You start complaining about all the work
exactly.
You're
doing. I'll stop now.
Okay, nicely done, Richie. You're learning from previous. This is what major tournament experience is all about. Great stuff, Richie. Jonathan, brilliant. Thanks a million.
Cheers, lads.
Cheers. Thank you.
That's Team Cheer and brings me back in. Aztec Gold.
Good guy.
Oh my God. Can somebody turn the treble up even more?
If I can change.
Hans was pleased in a postcard to St. Ingrievesy, Littlewood's Cup competition.
We don't have enough treble on this thing.
Richie mentioned he's going to be doing the France-Germany game, Ken, and he's got plenty of ammunition for that one. There are rumblings coming out of the French camp and not involving the man who people said might be a disruptive influence, Karim Benzema, coming back in.
Well, he kind of is involved, though, isn't he? He's a little bit involved in the sense that he's maybe his presence has altered the chemistry a little bit. And what we have here is a controversy that's been rumbling on, Owen. Ever since Olivier Giroud, after the win against Bulgaria, in which Giroud scored two goals, if you recall, having... did he replace Benzema? Benzema went off injured, and I guess Giroud came on for him. Giroud then scored two goals. But after the game, Giroud said, "I was a little quiet because sometimes I make runs and the balls aren't forthcoming. I'm not saying I always make the best runs, but I am seeking to offer solutions in the box." This was interpreted not least by Kylian Mbappe as an attack on Kylian Mbappe, who appears to have taken great umbrage at the idea that, is he saying I don't pass to him? Is he saying I don't pass to him? Because obviously, I think it's quite an interesting situation with Mbappe, given that he's like such a megastar now. Like in his press conference, which he wanted to do a press conference on Thursday, to immediately address this Giroud stuff, right? And Didier Deschamps said, "No way am I allowing you to do a press conference now. Calm down. I'm not letting you do one." But he did do one. He has since done one. So he's spoken about this. But just in terms of his profile, like, is so big now. Like in this press conference, for instance, he was asked questions like, "Is it true that you're like telling Nasser Al-Khelaifi at PSG who to sign?" And he's like, "No, absolutely not. I'm not talking about PSG here, but I will talk about that because that really annoys me. No." So evidently what it is like, it's all part of this, Mbappe's ego is out of control. Who does this guy think he is? You know what I mean? Now he won't even pass to Giroud. This is what's really annoying him about this.
Yeah.
Or what seems to really annoy. So he goes, "I spoke with Olivier Giroud. Everyone knows what happened. It's true that I was a little bit affected by it, but we're not going to make a big deal about it." He says, "We decided the best moment to explain myself was today, so I obeyed and came today." This obeyed Deschamps. "We didn't speak for long, but maybe because there were not too many things to say. On the pitch, it went well. After, everyone knows what happened. It is true I was a bit affected by that, but we're not going to make a big deal out of it. We're here to represent France. France is the most important thing. This is a major competition. Little quarrels are not going to interrupt our preparations. We're all focused on the Euros." And then they ask a couple of other questions, then they come back about it. "What annoyed you about what he said?" "Oh, was my previous answer not good? Okay, well, I will explain. It wasn't what he said. Honestly, what he said didn't bother me much at all. I'm an attacker. It's a feeling. He's expressing a feeling when he speaks. It doesn't bother me. I'm an attacker. I have this feeling 365 times during a match, and I'll have it more. The feeling that you're not, when you're not receiving service. It's more that he put it out there publicly. I saw him in the dressing room. I congratulated him for his two goals. He didn't say anything. And then I learned about this in the press. It is more that than what he said. Because what he said, there's nothing nasty about it. He's an attacker. He wants to score goals. And he's not far off of a certain record." That's the French national team record. I think he's the second top goal scorer.
Needs five goals, I think.
when you're an attacker, that goes around in your head. If he could have scored another, he would have. It's more putting it out there publicly. I would have liked him to come to me and to be more vicious, which by which he means to kind of say it to my face. You know, if you want to be angry to my face, say it. Don't just go snitching to the media. This is what Mbappe is saying. You know who I am in the dressing room. If I have something to say, I'll say it. I have no problem. It stays in the dressing room. It is not a problem. It is a little quarrel. I don't want our preparation to be that has started well. I don't want it to bother the team, blah, blah, blah. And they keep on going, oh, is this going to affect things? Of course it can't affect things. Of course, if things are not explained, if you leave something like that in the air, there will be a lot of things not said. The situation is clear. It was tense, but it is often like that. So you're like, I think this micro episode has distracted a little bit from the Euros. Then he's asked, do you play better with Karim Benzema in the team? And I have to say that Mbappe's answers are like impressively detailed and considered.
Great questions. That's a good question now. Nice loaded question to ask him in the middle of all this.
It is a good question, but listen to Mbappe returns this one like just like Rafa Nadal. Well, if I tell you he makes me play better, it's a bad answer. If I tell you that he does not make me play better, it is also a bad answer. Time will tell. He says that on top of a bunch of compliments of Benzema, but recognizes that there is no correct answer to this question. Then he talks about tactics a little bit. France are sort of switching between a 4-4-2 diamond and a 4-3-3. You know, when you have a number 10, you have the front two are more free. When you have a 4-3-3, you have a deep block that is more compact. That's holes. The coach will decide. We are there to execute. Of course, we speak, but he decides. And then they go back to the Giroud stuff. And this is the last bit of it, I know.
Yeah. Great. I love it. I mean, people do need to get on with these games today. But yeah, I'm liking this story.
They're like, oh, you know, well, you seem to give the ball faster to Neymar and Benzema than Giroud. Oh, they're completely different players. Completely different. We talk about Neymar. He touches 150 balls per match. Benzema touches the ball 80 times per match. And Olivier, he touches it a lot less because of his profile. If you compare how many passes I make to Benzema and Neymar versus Olivier, of course I pass less to Olivier. But that does not mean I am not looking for Olivier. It's just that his profile is different. Karim comes 40 meters deep to get the ball. Olivier likes to remain up top to be present in the box for the final balls. I think that is a bit unfair. You're trying to say things without saying them. You're basically saying that I don't want to pass to Olivier. That is your view. I respect it. That is your choice. I am telling you that they have different profiles. So he's basically saying your criticism is ignorant because everyone knows that all Olivier does is hatch in the box, looking to attack that tiny little channel of space around the 6-yard box. You know, it's like the Achilles heel, like the one patch of vulnerability on the body of the mighty warrior Achilles was just his Achilles tendon. It's like the one area of the pitch where Olivier Giroud is Pelé is just that, like, 4 square yards around the near post.
Yeah, Leroux Giroud, give it its proper name.
Leroux Giroud, and, you know, that's where he likes to hang out. That's where he's often found. But there's just not a passing lane to the Giroud. Can't get there from here, is what Kylian Mbappé is trying to tell you guys.
Brilliant. Love this story so much. Really looking forward to that game. That's tomorrow night. So we'll be covering that in Wednesday's podcast, France against Germany. On tomorrow's pod, we'll obviously be covering the Scots opener from today, whatever else happens. Spain playing tonight. A couple of decent things going on there. So yeah, members can hear this. Non-members won't hear. Become a member now. Your £5 a month plus VAT will get you to the end of June, well into the knockout stages. You can decide then if you want to sign up for the final stages of the tournament in July. So there you are. SecondCaptains.com. Thanks, Ken. Enjoyed that.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it also.
Thanks, everyone. Enjoy today's games. Bye.
Which one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.